forcing my humiliation and loneliness out of the way for just a while before they buoyed to the surface again. I thought about texting him, but it seemed like the weirdest possible time to start, so instead I went to sleep, a sick, anxious feeling coiled in my stomach. By Monday morning, he still wasn't back. Tonight, I decided. If his car wasn't along the curb tonight, I could text him. That wouldn't be weird. I put him out of my mind and pounded out 2,000 fresh words, then texted Anya. Going well. Actually, seriously, I mean it this time. But I'd like to get a little more done before anyone reads the partial. I think it's going to be hard to tell where I'm going with this without the complete picture, and I'm afraid if I jump forward to outline, it will kill all momentum I've finally built up. Next, I replied to Pete. Great, how does Wednesday work? The truth was, I could have come in on Sunday when I got the email, or on Monday when I sent the reply. But I didn't want another invitation to the Red Blood, White Russians, and Blue Jeans book club. Putting off my stop at the bookstore until Wednesday eliminated one more potential week of that whole experience without having to reject the invitation. By 11 that night, Gus's car still wasn't back, and I'd talked myself into and out of texting him 5 times. Finally, I put my phone in the drawer of the side table, clicked off the lamp, and went to sleep. Tuesday, I awoke soaked in sweat. I'd forgotten to set my alarm, and the sun was streaking through the blinds in full force, baking me in its pale light. It had to be close to 11. I slid out from under the thick duvet and lay there for another minute. I still felt a little sick, and then a little furious that I felt sick. It was so dumb. I was a grown woman. Gus had told me exactly how he operated, exactly what he thought about romance, and he'd never said or done anything to suggest he'd changed his mind. I knew that no matter how attracted to him I occasionally felt, the only place our relationship could go was through a revolving door in and out of his bedroom, or the back of my deeply uncool car. And even if things had gone further that night, it wouldn't have precluded him from disappearing for days. There was exactly one way that I could theoretically have Gus Everett, and it would leave me feeling sick like this as soon as it was over. I needed to get him out of my head. I took a cold shower, or at least I took 1 second of a cold shower, during which I screamed the F word and almost broke my ankle lunging away from the stream of water. How the hell were people in books always taking cold showers? I turned the water back to hot and fumed as I washed my hair. I wasn't mad at him. I couldn't be. I was furious with myself for wandering down this path. I knew better. Gus wasn't Jacques. Guys like Jacques wanted snowball fights and kisses at the top of the Eiffel Tower and sunrise strolls on the Brooklyn Bridge. Guys like Gus wanted snarky banter and casual sex on top of their unfolded laundry. In the back of your deeply uncool car at a family establishment. Although, I couldn't be sure that hadn't been my idea. It was conceivable that I'd thrown myself at him. It wouldn't be the first time I was seeing through rose-colored glasses, assigning meaning where there was none. I was being stupid. After everything with my dad, I should have known better. I'd just barely started to heal, and I'd run right out and gotten a crush on the one person who was guaranteed to prove right every single fear I had about relationships. I needed to let this go. Writing, I decided, would be my solace. It was slow going at first, every word a decision not to think about Gus disappearing. But after a while, I found a rhythm, almost as strong as yesterday's. The family circus wound up back in Oklahoma, close to where Eleanor's father's secret second family lived. A week, I decided. The bulk of this book was going to take place over the week the circus was parked in town TBD, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Writing in a different era presented a completely new challenge. I was leaving a lot of notes for myself, like, find out what drinks were popular then, or insert historically accurate insult. What mattered, though, was that I had a vision. All the secrets were going to come to the surface, almost win out, and then they'd be packed back down neatly. That was how an Augustus Everett novel would go, wouldn't it? He would say it had a nice cyclical quality when I told him, if I got the chance to tell him. I wanted the readers to be cheering, begging for Eleanor's found family to tell the truth by the end, while watching through their fingers, afraid of how the situation would implode. Someone needed a gun, I realized, and a reason to have a hair trigger reaction. Fear, of course. I needed to pressure cook the situation. Build and build, only to tamp it back down in time for the characters to move along to their next destination. Eleanor's father would owe money to dangerous men back in his hometown, ostensibly the reason he'd left in the first place, why he'd abandoned his family. Eleanor's mother would have the gun. It seemed only fair to give her something to fight with. But with it, she'd have to shoulder the weight of some PTSD, remnants of an old employer who liked to get violent with the girls who worked for him. She needed to be wound tight, ready to snap, like I'd been feeling this past year. Like I wanted Mom to be after the full extent of Dad's lies came to light. Eleanor, for her part, was going to fall in love with a local, or at least fancy herself having done so, the night of their first performance in Tulsa. She would spend the week moving closer to escaping the life she'd grown up in, only to have a horrible last-minute revelation that no matter how she might sometimes despise this world, it was the only one in which she belonged. Or maybe she would realize the world she'd lusted after, the one she'd watched from behind circus tents and atop tight ropes that filtered past while she was hard at work, was as much an illusion as the one she knew. The boy would fall in love with someone else, just as quickly as he had with her. Or the boy would leave for college, the military. Or his parents would find out about Eleanor and persuade him of his recklessness. It would be an anti-romance, and I was entirely capable of writing it. Chapter 15. The Past.
And there's the author herself, Pete called when I stepped into the coffee shop. A pink eye for you, hon?
Probably she meant red eye. Either way, I shook my head. What else do you recommend?
Green tea's good for you, Pete mused.
Well, sign me up. My body could use some antioxidants, or whatever was in green tea that made it good for you. Mom had told me, but the point had been pleasing her, not cleansing myself, so I didn't totally remember. Pete handed me the plastic cup, and this time she let me pay. I ignored the sinking in my stomach. How much money did I have left in my bank account? How long until I had to crawl back to my now ruined childhood home with my tail between my knees? I reminded myself that family_secrets.docx was rapidly growing into a book-like thing. Even one I'd be curious to read. Sandy Lowe might not end up wanting it, but surely someone would. Okay, not surely, but hopefully. Pete took off the apron as she led the way into the bookstore.
Maybe you should get a Clark Kent trench coat, I said. Seems like less hassle than bows and knots.
Yes, and who doesn't want to buy their coffee from a gal in a trench coat? Pete said.
Touché.
So here we go.
Pete stopped at the revelatories display, which was now only halfway a pyramid of revelatories. The other half was comprised of bubblegum pink, bright yellow, and sky blue books. Pete beamed.
Thought it would be kind of neat to do this local authors display, showcase the whole spectrum of what we've got going on here in North Bear. What do you think? Grab a stack, by the way.
Pete was already carrying an armload over to the counter, where a roll of autographed stickers and a couple of Sharpies awaited.
It's great, I said, following her with another stack. And Everett? She said.
Great, I answered, accepting the uncapped Sharpie she was pushing into my hand. She started flipping to title pages and sliding books across for me to sign one at a time.
Sounds like you two have been spending a lot of time together.
I balked. Sounds like? Pete threw her back into her guffaw.
You know, as private as that boy is, I have to pull a lot from context out of our conversations. But yes, I've gathered the clues that you two have formed a friendship.
I tried to hide my surprise.
You talk often? He probably answers about a third or so of my calls. Sure, I drive him batty calling as much as I do, but I worry. We're the only family each other's got here.
Family? I looked up at her, no longer hiding my confusion. Her own features seemed to snap upward on her face, surprised. She scratched the back of her head.
I thought you knew. I never can tell what he thinks is private and what isn't. So much of it shows up in his books, you'd think he'd be comfortable peeling off his skin and parading through Times Square. Of course, that might just be me projecting. I know how you artist types are. He insists it's fiction, so I should read it as such.
I was barely tracking. Apparently, my face revealed that, because Pete explained,
I'm his aunt. His mother was my sister.
A wave of dizziness hit me. The shop seemed to rock. This didn't make sense. 2.5 weeks of near constant, albeit non-traditional, communication, and Gus hadn't even shared the most basic parts of his life with me. But you call him Everett, I said. You're his aunt and you don't use his first name. She stared at me for a moment, confused.
Oh, that. An old habit. When he was a little guy, I coached his soccer team. Couldn't show favoritism, called him by his last name like any other player, and it stuck. Half the time, I forget he has a first name. Hell, I've introduced him as Everett to half the town by now.
I felt like I'd just dropped a wooden doll only to watch 6 more fall out and discover it had been a matryoshka. There was the Gus I knew, funny, messy, sexy. And then there was the other Gus, who disappeared for days, who had played soccer as a kid and lived in the same town as his aunt, who said no more than he absolutely had to about himself, his family, his past, while I spilled wine, tears, and my guts all over him. I bent my head and went back to signing in silence. Pete kept sliding books across the counter to me, stacking the signed ones neatly on my other side. After a handful of seconds, she said,
Be patient with him, January. He really likes you.
I kept signing.
I think you're misunderstanding the... I'm not, she said.
I looked into her fierce blue eyes, held her gaze.
He told me about the day you moved in. Not a wonderful first impression. It's a recurring issue of his.
So I hear.
But of course you have to give him a break on that one, she said. His birthday's really hard for him ever since the split.
Birthday? I parroted, looking up.
Split? I thought.
Pete looked surprised, then unsure.
She left him on it, you know. And every year since then, his friend Markham throws this huge party to try to keep his mind off it. And of course, Gus hates parties, but he doesn't want Markham thinking he's upset, so he lets the party happen.
Excuse me? I choked out. Was this some kind of joke? Had Pete woken up this morning and thought, maybe today I shall release snippets of shocking information about Gus to January in a random yet cryptic order? She left him on his birthday? I repeated.
He didn't tell you that was what had gotten a bee in his bonnet that night you moved in? She said. Now that really does surprise me. If he'd told you he'd been thinking about his divorce, of course it would have explained how rude he was to you.
Divorce, I said, my whole body going cold. It was about his divorce. Gus was divorced. Gus had been married. Pete shifted uncomfortably.
I'm surprised he didn't tell you. He felt so bad about being rude.
My brain felt like a top spinning in my skull. It didn't make sense. None. Gus couldn't have been married. He didn't even date. The store seemed to wobble around me.
I didn't mean to upset you, Pete said. I only thought it might explain.
No, it's fine, I said. And then it was happening again, the words spilling. The feeling that I'd held everything in a moment too long and now had no choice over how much I let out. I'm probably overreacting. This year's been weird for me. Like, in my mind, marriage has always been this sacred thing, you know? Like the epitome of love, the kind that can weather anything. And I hate thinking some bad experiences justify people shitting on the entire concept. Gus shitting on the concept, calling relationships sadomasochistic without even telling me he'd been married, almost making me feel stupid for wanting and believing in lasting love just because his own attempt hadn't worked, hiding that attempt from me. But even so, why did I care what he thought? I shouldn't need everyone to believe in or want the things I believed in and wanted. When it came down to it, I resented the fact that some part of him must think I was stupid for still believing in something my own father had disproven. And beyond that, I resented myself for not letting go of it, for still wanting that love I'd always pictured for myself. And a small, stupid part of me even resented that Gus had secretly loved someone enough to marry her, while one brief makeout session with me had apparently been enough to make him relocate to Antarctica without so much as a see ya. "I don't know," I said, shaking my head. "Does that make sense?" "Of course it does." Pete squeezed my arm. I had a feeling she would have said that even if it didn't. Like maybe she just knew it was what I needed to hear right then. Chapter 16. The Porch Furniture. Thursday at noon, Gus was back at his kitchen table, looking less sexily disheveled and more like he'd been dragged behind a dump truck with a loose tailgate. He smiled and waved, and I returned the gesture, despite the sick roiling in my stomach. He scribbled a note. "Sorry I've been MIA this week." I wished that hadn't replaced the nausea with the zero-gravity rush of a roller coaster loop. I looked around. I hadn't brought my notebook in today. I went into the bedroom and grabbed it, writing, "Nothing to be sorry about," as I ambled back into the room. I held the note aloft. Gus's smile wavered. He nodded, then jerked his attention back to his laptop. It was harder to focus on writing now that he was back, but I did my best. I was about a quarter of the way through the book, and I needed to keep up. Around 5, I, discreetly, at least I hoped, watched Gus get up and move around the kitchen, making some semblance of a meal. When he'd finished, he sat back down at his computer. At about 8:30, he looked up at me and tipped his head toward the deck. This had been our signal, as close to an invitation as either of us got before we moseyed onto our respective decks and not quite hung out at night. Now that seemed like a blatantly obvious metaphor, his keeping a literal gulf between us, my readily meeting him each night. No wonder I'd gotten so confused. He'd been keeping careful boundaries, and I'd been ignoring them. I was so bad at this, so unprepared to find myself drawn to someone completely emotionally unavailable. I shook my head to Gus's invitation, then added a written note to my pass. "Sorry, too much to do, Anya on my ass." Gus nodded understanding. He stood, mouthing something along the lines of, "If you change your mind," then disappeared from sight for a moment and reappeared on his deck. He walked to its farthest point and leaned across the railing. The breeze fluttered through his shirt, lifting his left sleeve up against the back of his arm. At first, I thought he'd gotten a new tattoo, a large black circle solidly filled in, but then I realized it was exactly where his Mobius strip had been. Only that had been blotted out entirely since I last spotted it. He stayed out there like that until the sun had gone down and night cloaked everything in rich blues, the fireflies coming to life around him, a million tiny nightlights switched on by a cosmic hand. He glanced over his shoulder toward my deck doors, and I looked sharply toward my screen, typing the words, "pretending to be busy, very busy, and focused," to complete the illusion. Actually, I'd been at my computer for nearly 12 hours, and I'd only typed 1,000 new words. Though I'd managed to open 14 tabs on my web browser, including 2 separate Facebook tabs. I needed to get out of the house. When Gus looked away again, I sneaked from the table out to the front porch. The air was dense with humidity, but not uncomfortably hot. I perched on the wicker couch and surveyed the houses across the street. I hadn't spent much time out here, since the water was behind Gus's and my side of the street,
But the cottages and dollhouses on the other side were cute and colorful, every porch packed with its own variation on the lawn furniture theme. None was so homey or eclectic as the set Sonia had chosen. If I'd had no negative ties to this furniture, I'd be sad to have to sell it. But I figured now was as good a time as any. It'd be one less thing to worry about later. I stood and flicked on the porch light, snapping pictures of each individual piece and some of the whole set, then pulled up Craigslist on my phone. I stared at it for a moment, then exited the browser and opened my email. I could still see the bolded words from Sonia's last message. I hadn't deleted any of them, but I didn't want to read them either. I opened a new email and addressed it to her. Subject: Porch Furniture. Hi, I'm beginning to sort out things at the house. Did you want the furniture on the porch, or should I sell it? I tried out three separate signatures, but none seemed right. In the end, I decided not to leave so much as a J behind. I hit send. That was it. All the emotional labor I had in me for the day. So I washed my face, brushed my teeth, and climbed into bed, where I watched Veronica Mars until the sun came up. On Friday, the knocking on my door came hours earlier than I'd expected. It was 2:30 in the afternoon, and as I'd fallen asleep at 5 that morning, I'd only been awake for a couple of hours by then. I grabbed my robe off the couch and pulled it over my outfit, boxers stolen from Jacques, and my worn-out David Bowie shirt minus a bra. I drew back the linen curtain that covered the window set into the door and saw Gus pacing on the porch, his hands locked behind his head and pulling it down as if stretching his neck. He stopped, wide-eyed, and spun toward me as I opened the door. "What's wrong?" I asked. In that moment, I saw the part of his gene pool that overlapped with Pete's in the way that his expression shifted from confusion to surprise. He shook his head quickly. "Dave's here." "Dave?" I said. "Dave as in Dave? Of Olive Garden fame?"
"It's definitely not Wendy's, Dave," Gus confirmed. "He called me a minute ago and said he was in town. He drove out on an impulse, I guess. He's in my house right now. Can you come over?"
"Now?" I said dumbly.
"Yes, January, now, because he's in my house, now."
"Yes," I said. "Just let me get dressed." I shut the door and ran back to the bedroom. I'd fallen behind on laundry this week. The only clean thing I had was the stupid black dress, so naturally I wore a dirty t-shirt and a pair of jeans. Gus's door was unlocked, and I let myself in without thinking. When I stepped inside, it all struck me. We'd been friends almost a month, and I was finally in the house I'd peered curiously into that first night. I was tucked between those dark shelves, far overstuffed with books, Gus's smoky incense smell in the air. The space was lived in, books left open on tables, stacks of mail on top of anthologies and literary journals, a mug here or there on a coaster. But compared to his usual level of sloppiness, the room was meticulously neat.
"January?"
The narrow hall that veered straight into the kitchen seemed to swallow his voice.
"We're in here."
I followed it as if it were breadcrumbs leading to some fantastical place. That, or a trap. I stopped in the kitchen, a mirror image of mine. On the left, a breakfast nook, where the table I'd seen Gus sit behind so often was pushed almost flush to the window, and the counters and cupboards on the right. Gus waved at me from the next room over, a little office. I wanted to take my time, to examine every inch of this house full of secrets, but Gus was watching me in that focused way that made it seem like he might be reading my thoughts, so I hurried into the office. A minimalist desk, all sleek Scandinavian lines and utterly free of clutter, was pushed against the back window. Where Gus's house sat, his deck overlooked the woods, but the trees fell away before the furthest right side of the building, and here the view of the beach was unobstructed, the silvery light filtering through the clouds, bouncing along the tops of the waves like skipped stones. Dave wore a red t-shirt and a mesh-backed hat. Bags hung under his eyes, giving him the look of a sleepy Saint Bernard.
He took his hat off and stood as I entered the room, but didn't stretch out his hand, which gave me the disorienting feeling of having wandered into a Jane Austen novel. "Hi," I said. "I'm January."
"Pleasure," Dave said with a nod.
There was a desk chair, turned away from the desk so Gus could face the rest of the tiny room, an armchair wedged into the corner, which Dave had evacuated when he stood, and a kitchen chair Gus had clearly brought in especially for the occasion. Dave sat back in that one, gesturing for me to take the armchair. "Thanks," I sat, inserting myself into the triangle of chairs and knees. "And thanks so much for talking to us." Dave put his hat back on and swiveled the bill anxiously.
"I wasn't ready before. Sorry for wasting y'all's time, driving out my way. Feel awfully bad."
"No need," Gus assured him. "We know how sensitive all this is."
He nodded.
"And my sobriety. I just wanted to be sure I could handle it. I went to a meeting that night, when we were supposed to meet at the Olive Garden, that's where I was."
"Totally understandable," Gus said.
"This is just a book. You're a person."
Just a book. The phrase caught me off guard coming from Gus's mouth. Gus, books with happy endings are dishonest, Everett. Gus, drinking the goddamn literary Kool-Aid Everett, had said the words, "just a book." And for some reason, that unraveled me a bit. Gus has been married. He caught me staring. I looked away.
"That's just it," Dave said. "It's a book. It's a chance to tell a story that might help people like me."
The corner of Gus's mouth twisted uncomfortably. I still hadn't read my new copy of The Revelatories. I was afraid of how it might dim or exacerbate my crush on him. But from everything Gus had said, I knew he wasn't writing to save lives so much as to understand what had destroyed them. Gus's rom-com was supposed to be different, but I couldn't imagine him using anything Dave had said to tell a story with a meet-cute and a happily ever after. The contents of this interview would be far more at home in his next literary masterpiece. Then again, this was Gus. When we'd started down this path, I'd thought I'd be writing bullshit, just mimicking what I'd seen other people do. But really, my new project was as quintessentially me as anything else I'd written. Maybe Gus's rom-com really would have a place like New Eden as a backdrop, all kinds of horrible things happening between kisses and professions of love. Maybe he was finally going to give someone the happy ending they deserved in a book about a cult. Or maybe Dave was barking up the wrong tree.
"It will be honest," Gus told him. "But it won't be New Eden. It won't be you. It will, hopefully, be a place you can imagine existing. Characters you believe could be real."
He paused, thinking.
"And if we're lucky, maybe it will help someone to feel known and understood, like their story matters."
Gus glanced at me so fast I almost missed it. My stomach somersaulted as I realized he was quoting me, something I'd said that night we'd made our deal, and I didn't think he was teasing me. I thought he meant it.
"But even if not," he went on, focusing on Dave, "just knowing you told it might help you."
Dave pulled at a stray thread peeling out of the hole in the knee of his jeans.
"I know that. I just had to make sure my ma understood. She still feels bad. Like she could have maybe talked my dad out of staying, gotten him to leave with us. He'd still be alive, she thinks. And you?"
Gus asked. Dave scrunched up his lips.
"Do you believe in fate, Augustus?"
Gus hid his grimace at the name.
"I think some things are inevitable."
Dave slumped forward, tugged on his hat bill.
"Used to sleepwalk as a kid. Real bad habit, scary stuff. Once, before we went to New Eden, my mom found me standing at the edge of our apartment's pool with a butter knife in my hand, naked. I didn't even sleep naked. 2 weeks before we joined New Eden, we'd been at a park, just Ma and me, when a storm started up. She always liked the rain, so we stayed out too long. Thunder got going, big, scary clashes, so we started running home. There was a chain-link fence around the park, and when we reached it, she yelled for me to wait. She wasn't sure how lightning worked, but she figured it was a bad idea to let her 6-year-old grab a fistful of metal. She wrapped her hand in her shirt and opened the gate for me. We got all the way home. We were on the front steps when it happened. A crack like a giant axe had hit the world. Honest to God, I thought the sun was crashing into Earth. That's how bright the light was.
What light? Gus said.
The bolt of lightning that hit me,
Dave said.
We weren't religious people, Augustus, especially not my dad. But that scared Ma. She decided to make a change. We went to church that next week, the strictest one she could find, and on our way out, someone handed her a flyer. New Eden, it said. God is inviting you to a new beginning. Will you answer?
Gus was writing notes, nodding as he went.
So she took that as a sign? She thought God had saved my life,
Dave said,
just to get her attention. A week later, we were moving into the compound, and Dad went along with it. He didn't believe, but he considered a child's spiritual upbringing to be the job of the mother. I don't know what got him, what changed his mind, but over the next 2 years, he got in deeper than Ma ever had. And then, one night, she woke up in our trailer with a bad feeling. There was a storm raging outside, and she peeked her head into the living room where I slept, and the fold-out was empty. Just a bunch of rumpled blankets. She tried to wake my dad, but he slept like a rock. So she went out into the storm, found me standing there, naked as can be in the middle of the woods, lightning touching down around me like falling fireworks. And you know what happened next?
Dave looked at me, paused.
It hit the trailer. The whole thing went up in flames. That was the first fire at New Eden, and it wasn't a bad one. Not like the one that killed my dad. They got that first one out before it could do much damage. But my mom took me out of there the next day. She took it as another sign,
Gus confirmed.
See, here's the thing,
Dave said.
My mom believes in fate, in destiny, in the divine hand of God. But not so much that there's no room to blame herself for what happened to my dad. She was the one who brought us there. And she was the one who took me out. She didn't tell him because she knew he was in too deep. He wouldn't have just refused to leave. He would have atoned for us.
Atoned? I said.
Lingo,
Dave explained.
It's a confession on someone else's behalf. They didn't want us to think of it as reporting, keeping tabs on your neighbors. It was atoning. It was making the selfless sacrifice of putting a wedge in your own relationship with a person in order to save them from sin. Deep down, she knew that if she told Dad she wanted out, we both would have been punished. She would have gotten at least 2 weeks in isolation. I would have been beaten, then stuck with another family until her wavering faith had been restored. They said they didn't like the violence, that it was their own sacrifice to discipline us out of love. But you could always tell the ones who did. She knew all that. So, fated or not, my mom saw the future. She couldn't have saved him. But she did what she had to do to save me.
Gus was silent, thoughtful. Lost in thought, he looked suddenly younger, a little softer. I felt a rush of anger low in my stomach. Why didn't someone save you? I thought. Why didn't someone scoop you up and run you out in the middle of the night? I knew it was complicated. I knew there must have been reasons, but it still sent a pang through me. It wasn't the story I would have written for him. Not at all. Gus shut the door behind Dave with a quiet click and turned to face me. For a moment, we said nothing, both exhausted from the 4-hour interview. We just looked at each other. He leaned against the door.
Hey,
he said finally. Hey, I answered. A wisp of smile sneaked up the corner of his mouth.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, I shifted between my feet. You too. He straightened and went toward the walnut sideboard in the corner,
pulling two crystal highball glasses from below and setting them beside the careful arrangement of dark liquor bottles.
Want a drink?
Of course I wanted a drink. I'd just heard a harrowing tale of a child beaten for imaginary crimes, and aside from that, I was alone with Gus for the first time since our kiss. Even from across the room, the heat in the house felt like a stand-in for our tension, for the thorny jumble of feelings today had stirred up in me. Anger with all the broken parents, heartache that they too must have felt like kids. Helpless, unsure how to make the right decisions, terrified of making the wrong ones. I felt sick for Dave and what he'd been through, sad for my mother and how lost I knew she must feel without Dad. And still, even with all that, being in the same room as Gus made me feel a little warm and heavy, like from across the room he was still a physical force pressing into me. I heard the soft clink of ice against the glasses. He kept ice in a bucket on a tray with his liquor? How moneyed Connecticutian of him. I wanted answers about Pete and about Gus's parents and his marriage, but those were the sorts of tidbits a person had to offer up, and Gus hadn't. He hadn't even let me into his house until one of his research subjects had shown up here unannounced. Not that he'd been in my house either, but my house wasn't a part of me. It wasn't even really mine, it was just baggage. Gus's house was his home. And Dave had been inside before I had. Gus turned then to look at me, brow furrowed. You got a tattoo. It was the first thing I could think to say when we'd been silent too long. His eyes darted toward his arm.
I did.
That was it. No explanation, no information about where he'd been. I was welcome to sit here, to have a drink with him and talk about books and meaningless memories of girls puking on the backs of our heads, but that was it. My heart sank. I didn't want that. Not now that I'd had glimpses of more. If I wanted casual, surface-level chit-chat and conversational landmines, I'd call my mom. With him, I wanted more. It was who I was.
Scotch?
Gus asked. I didn't get much done today. I should get back to it.
Yeah.
He started nodding, slowly, distractedly.
Yeah, okay. Tomorrow, then.
Tomorrow, I said. For once, I was dreading planning our Saturday night. He left the glasses on the sideboard and came to open the door for me. I stepped onto the porch, but hesitated at the sound of my own name. When I looked back, his left temple was resting against the door jamb. He was always leaning on something, like he couldn't bear to hold all his own weight upright for more than a second or two. He lounged, he sprawled, he hunched and reclined. He never simply stood or sat. In college, I'd thought he was lazy about everything except writing. Now I wondered if he was simply tired, if life had beaten him into a permanent slouch, folded him over himself so no one could get at that soft center, the kid who dreamed of running away on trains and living in the branches of a redwood. Yeah, I said.
It's good to see you.
He said. You said that already.
Yeah,
he replied.
I did.
I fought a smile, stifled a flutter in my stomach. A smile and a flutter weren't enough for me. I was done with secrets and lies, no matter how pretty. Good night, Gus. Chapter 17. The Dance. Tux tonight, Gus wrote at noon on Saturday. Anxiety crept up every time I thought about being alone in the car with him. But I'd also had tonight planned since last Saturday, and I wasn't ready to bow out of our deal, not when I was finally writing for the first time in months. Oh, definitely, I wrote back. Seriously? Gus asked. No, I wrote. Do you have cowboy boots? What do you think? Gus said. From everything you know about me, take a wild guess whether I own cowboy boots. I stared at the blank page, then went for it. You're a man of many secrets. You could have a whole closet full of 10-gallon hats, and if you do, wear one, 6 p.m. When Gus appeared at my door that night, he was wearing his usual uniform, plus a wrinkly black button-up. His hair was swept up his forehead in a way that suggested it had been forced there via him anxiously running his hand through it while he wrote. "No hat?" I said.
"No hat."
He pulled his other hand from behind his back. He was holding two flasks, the thin, foldable kind you could tuck under your clothes.
"But I brought these in case you're taking me to a Texan church service."
I crouched by the front door, tugging my embroidered ankle boots on. "And once again, you reveal that you know much more about romance than you've previously let on." Even as I said it, my stomach clenched. Gus has been married. Gus is divorced. That was why he was so sure love could never last, and he'd told me none of these key details because he hadn't really let me in. If my comment reminded him of any of that, he didn't let on.
"Just so you know," he said, "if I actually have to wear a cowboy hat at some point tonight, I will probably die."
"Cowboy hat allergy." I grabbed my keys from the table. "Got it. Let's go." This date would have been perfect if it had been a date. The parking lot of the Black Cat Saloon was jammed, and the rough-hewn interior was just as packed.
"A lot of flannel," Gus mused as we made our way in.
"What do you expect on line dancing night, Gus?"
"You're kidding, right?"
Gus said, freezing. I shook my head.
"This has been an exact recurring nightmare I'm only just realizing was actually a premonition."
On the low stage at the front of the barn-like room, the band picked up again, and a crush of bodies moved past on our left, knocking me into him. He caught me around the ribcage and righted me as the group pushed toward the dance floor.
"You good?"
he shouted over the music, his hands still on my ribs. My face was hot, my stomach flipping traitorously.
"Fine."
He leaned in so I could hear him.
"This seems like a dangerous environment for someone your size. Maybe we should leave and go literally anywhere else."
As he eased back to look me in the face, I grinned and shook my head. "No way. The lesson doesn't even start for another 10 minutes. His hands slid off me, leaving pulsing points behind on my skin.
"I guess I survived Meg Ryan."
"Barely," I teased, then blushed as flashes of memory seared across my mind. Gus's mouth tipping mine open, Gus's teeth on my clavicle, Gus's hands tightening against my hips, his thumb scraping over the jut of bone. The moment stretched out between us. Or rather, it seemed to tighten between us. And since we didn't move any closer, the air grew taut. The song was winding down now, and a lanky man with a horsey face bounded onto the stage with a microphone, summoning beginners to the floor for the next song. I grabbed Gus's wrist and cut a path through the crowd to the dance floor. For once, his cheeks were flushed, his forehead dented with worried wrinkles.
"You honestly have to write me into your will for this," he said.
"You might not want to talk through the instructions," I replied, tipping my head toward the horse-faced caller, who was using a volunteer from the crowd to demonstrate a few key moves, all while talking with the speed of an auctioneer. "I have a feeling this guy won't be repeating much."
"Your last will and testament, January,"
Gus whispered fiercely.
"And to Gus Everett," I whispered back, "a closet full of 10-gallon hats."
His laugh crackled like popping oil. I thought of its sound against my ear that night at the party. We hadn't said anything as we danced in that slick basement, not a single word, but he'd laughed against my ear and I'd known, or at least suspected, that it was because he was dimly aware that we should have been embarrassed to be all over each other like that. We should have been, but there were more pressing feelings to be felt that night, just like at the drive-in. Heat filled my abdomen, and I suppressed the thought. On stage, the fiddle started up, and soon the whole band was bouncing through the notes. The experts swarmed the floor, filling in the gaps between the anxiously waiting beginners, of whom we made up at least 20%. Gus pushed in close at my side, unwilling to be separated from the sentient safety blanket I'd become as soon as we'd walked through the metal double doors, and the caller shouted into the microphone, "Y'all ready? Here we go." At his first command, the crowd jostled to the right, carrying Gus and me with it. He snatched my hand as the mass of boots and heels reversed direction. I squealed as Gus jerked me out of the path of a man on a mission to Grapevine, whether it meant stomping on my foot or not. There were no sung lyrics, just the caller's instructions, with their strange auctioneer rhythm and the sound of shoes scuffing along the floor. I erupted into laughter as Gus went forward instead of back, eliciting a nasty glare from the hairsprayed blonde he collided with.
"Sorry,"
he shouted over the music, holding up his hands in surrender, only to get bumped into her pink, lace-covered chest as the crowd shifted once more.
"Oh, God," he said, stumbling back. "Sorry, I—"
"God has nothing to do with it,"
the woman snapped, digging her hands into her hips.
"Sorry,"
I interceded, grabbing Gus by the hand.
"Can't take him anywhere."
"Me?"
he cried, half laughing.
"You knocked me into—"
I pulled him through the crowd to the far side of the dance floor. When I looked over my shoulder, the woman had resumed her boot-scoot boogieing, face as stony as a sarcophagus's.
"Should I give her my number?"
Gus teased, mouth close to my ear.
"I think she'd rather have your insurance card.
Or a good police sketch.
Or a crowbar," I shot back.
"Okay."
Gus's smile spread enough for a laugh to slip out.
"That's enough from you. You're just looking for an excuse not to dance."
"I'm just looking for an excuse," I said. "You grabbed that woman's boobs to try to get kicked out of here."
"No way."
He shook his head, caught my arm, and tugged me along as he clumsily fell back into the steps.
"I'm in this for the long haul now. You'd better clear your Saturday schedules from here until eternity."
I laughed, tripping along with him, but my stomach was fighting a series of concurrent rises and dips. I didn't want to feel these things. It wasn't fun anymore, now that I was thinking it all through, where it would end up, with me attached and jealous, and him having shared about as much about his life with me as you might with a hairdresser. But then he would say things like that, "Clear your Saturday schedule from here until eternity." He would grab me around the waist to keep me from smashing into a support beam I hadn't noticed in my dancing fugue state. Laughing, he would twirl me into him and spin me around while the rest of the crowd was walking their feet into their bodies and back out, far wider than their hips, thumbs hooked into real and imagined belt loops. This was a different Gus than I'd seen. The one who'd played soccer? The Gus who answered one-third of his aunt's phone calls? The Gus who'd been married and divorced? And I wasn't sure what to make of it, or its sudden appearance. Something had changed in him again, and he was, whether intentionally or not, letting it show. He seemed somehow lighter than he had, less tired. He was being winsome and flirty, which only made me more frustrated after the past week.
"We need a shot," he said.
"Okay,"
I agreed. Maybe a shot would take the strange edge I was feeling off. We swam back to the bar, and he nudged aside a pool of peanuts still in their shells to order two doubles of whiskey.
"Cheers,"
he said, lifting his. "To what?" I asked. He smirked.
"To your happy endings."
I'd thought we were friends, that he respected me. And now I felt like he was calling me a fairy princess all over again, laughing to himself about how naive and silly my worldview was, holding his failed marriage like a secret trump card that proved, once again, he knew more than me. A fierce, angry fuse lit in my stomach, and I threw back the whiskey without meeting his lifted shot. Gus seemed to think it was an oversight. He was still downing his whiskey as I headed back out to the dance floor. I had to admit, there was something singularly hilarious about line dancing angrily, but that didn't stop me from doing it. We finished two more songs, took two more shots. When we went back out for the fourth song, a more complex dance for the proficient to enjoy while the caller used the toilet and rested his vocal cords, we had no hope of keeping up with the choreography, even if we hadn't been tipsy by then. During a double turn to the right, my shoe caught on an uneven floorboard, and Gus grabbed me by the waist to keep me from going down. His laughter faded when he saw my face, and he leaned, of course, against the support beam,
my nemesis from earlier, drawing me in toward him by my hips. His hand burned through my jeans into my skin, and I fought to keep a clear head as he held me like that.
"Hey,"
he murmured, dropping his mouth toward my ear so I could hear him over the music.
"What's wrong?"
What was wrong was his thumbs twirling circles on my hips, his whiskey breath against the corner of my mouth, and how stupid I felt for its effect on me. I was naive. I'd always trusted my parents, never sensed the missing pieces between Jacques and me, and now I'd started getting emotionally attached to someone who'd done everything he could to convince me not to. I stepped back from him. I meant to say, "I think I need to go home," or maybe, "I'm not feeling well." But I'd never been good at hiding how I was feeling, especially this past year. I didn't say anything. I just ran for the door. I burst into the cool air of the parking lot and beelined toward the Kia. I could hear him shouting my name as he followed, but I was too embarrassed, frustrated, and I didn't know what else to turn around.
"January?"
Gus said again, jogging toward me. "I'm fine." I dug for my keys in my pocket. I need to go home. I trailed off, fumbling the key against the lock.
"We can't go anywhere until we've sobered up," he pointed out.
"Then I'll just sit in the car until then." My hands were shaking, and the key glanced off the lock again.
"Here, let me."
Gus took it from me and slipped it in, unlocking the driver's side door, but he didn't step away to let me open it.
"Thanks,"
I said without looking at him. I flinched as his hand brushed at my face, swiping hair from my cheek. He tucked it behind my ear.
"Whatever it is, you can tell me."
Now I looked up at him, ignoring the heavy flip-flop of my stomach as I met his eyes.
"Why?"
His eyebrows lifted.
"Why what?"
"Why can I tell you?" I said. "Why would I tell you anything?" His mouth pressed closed. The muscle in his jaw leapt.
"What is this? What did I do?"
"Nothing." I turned toward the car, but Gus's body still blocked the door. "Move, Gus."
"This isn't fair," he said. "You're mad at me and I can't even try to fix it? What could I have possibly—"
"I'm not mad at you," I said.
"You are,"
he argued. I tried again to open the door. This time, he moved aside to let me.
"Please tell me, January."
"I'm not," I insisted, voice shaking dangerously. "I'm not mad at you. We're not even close enough for that. I'm just your casual acquaintance. It's not like we're friends." Twin grooves rose from the insides of his eyebrows, and his crooked mouth twisted.
"Please,"
he said, almost out of breath.
"Don't do this."
"Do what?" I demanded. He threw his arms out to the sides.
"I don't know," he said. "Whatever this is."
"How stupid do you think I am?"
"What are you talking about?" he demanded.
"I guess I shouldn't be surprised you don't tell me anything," I said. "It's not like you respect me or my opinions."
"Of course I respect you."
"I know you were married," I blurted. "I know you were married and that you split up on your birthday, and not only did you not tell me any of that, but you listened to me spill my guts about why I do what I do and what it all means to me and talk about my dad and what he did, and you sat there on your smug little high horse." Gus gave an exasperated laugh.
"Little high horse?
Thinking I was stupid or naive?
Of course I don't.
Keeping your own failed marriage a secret, just like everything else in your life, so you can look down on all the cliché people like me who still believe—"
"Stop," he snapped.
"While you—"
"Stop."
He jerked back from me, walked down the length of the car, then turned back, face angry.
"You don't know me, January."
I laughed humorlessly. "I'm aware."
"No."
He shook his head, stormed back toward me, and stopped no more than 6 inches away.
"You think my marriage is a joke to me? I was married 2 years. 2 years before my wife left me for the best man at our wedding. How's that for cliche?
I know goldfish that lived longer than that. I didn't even want the divorce. I would have stayed with her even after the affair, but guess what, January? Happy endings don't happen to everyone. There's nothing you can do to make someone keep loving you. Believe it or not, I don't just sit through hours of conversations with you silently judging you. And if it takes me a while to tell you things like, hey, my wife left me for my college roommate, maybe it has nothing to do with you, okay? Maybe it's because I don't like saying that sentence aloud. I mean, your mom didn't leave when your dad cheated on her, and my mom didn't leave my dad when he broke my fucking arm, and yet I couldn't do anything to make my wife stay! My stomach bottomed out. My throat clenched. Pain stabbed through my chest. It all made sense at once. The hesitancy and deflection, the mistrust of people, the fear of commitment. No one had chosen Gus. From the time he was a kid, no one had chosen him, and he was embarrassed by that, like it meant something about him. I wanted to tell him it didn't, that it wasn't because he was broken, but because everyone else was. But I couldn't get any words out. I couldn't do anything but stare at him, standing there, out of steam, his chest rising and falling with heavy breaths, and ache for him, and hate the world a little for chewing him up. Right then, I honestly didn't care why he'd disappeared or where he'd gone. The hard glint had left his eyes, and his chin dropped as he rubbed at his forehead. There were millions of things I wanted to say to him, but what came out was, Parker? He looked up again, eyes wide and mouth ajar. What? Your college roommate, I murmured. Do you mean Parker? Gus's mouth closed, the muscles along his jaw leaping. Yeah, he barely said. Parker. Parker, the art student with the eccentric clothes. Parker, who'd picked most of his left eyebrow away. He'd had pretty blue eyes and a certain zaniness that my friends and I had always imagined translated to a golden retriever-esque excitability when it came to sex, which we were all fairly sure he was getting a lot of. Gus wasn't looking at me. He was rubbing his forehead again, looking as broken and embarrassed as I'd felt 30 seconds ago. On your birthday? What an asshole. I didn't realize I'd said it aloud until he responded, I mean, that wasn't her plan. He looked away, staring vaguely through the parking lot. I sort of dragged it out of her. I could tell something was wrong, and anyway. Still an asshole, I thought. I shook my head. I had no idea what else to say. I stepped forward and wrapped my arms around him, pressing my face into his neck, feeling his deep breaths push against me. After a moment, his arms lifted around me, and we stood there, just out of reach of the parking lot's lone floodlight, holding on to each other. I'm sorry, I whispered into his skin. She should have picked you. And I meant it, even if I wasn't sure exactly which she I was talking about. His arms tightened around my back. His mouth and nose pressed against the crown of my head, and inside, a mournful Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young cover picked up, guitar twanging like its strings were crying. Gus rocked me side to side. I want to know you, I told him. I want that, he murmured into my hair. We stood there for another moment before he spoke again. It's late. We should grab some coffee inside so we can get home. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to pull away from Gus. Sure. He eased back from me, and his hand ran down my throat, resting on the crook between my neck and shoulder, his rough thumb catching the edge of my collarbone. He shook his head once. I've never thought you were stupid. I nodded. I wasn't sure what to say. And even if I had been, I wasn't sure if my voice would come out thick and heavy, like my blood felt, or shaky and high, like my stomach did. Gus's eyes dipped to my mouth, then rose to my eyes. I thought, think, it's brave to believe in love. I mean, the lasting kind, to try for that, even knowing it can hurt you.
And what about you?
What about me? He murmured.
I needed to clear my throat, but I didn't.
It would be too obvious what I was thinking, how I was feeling.
You don't think you ever will again?
Gus stepped back, shoes crackling against the gravel. It doesn't matter if I believe it can work or not, he said. Not believing in something doesn't stop you from wanting it, if you're not careful.
His gaze sent heat unfurling over me, the cold snapping painfully back into place against my skin when he finally turned back toward the bar.
Come on, he said. Let's get that coffee. Careful.
Caution was something I had little of when it came to Gus Everett. Case in point, my hangover the next morning. I awoke to my first text from him. It said only, ow. Chapter 18. The X. There were no more nights on our separate decks. On Sunday, Gus came to my house looking like he'd started going through a trash compactor, only for it to spit him back up halfway through. I felt at least as bad as he looked. We put the chaise lounges on the deck flat and lay out there with ice packs on our heads, chugging the bottles of Gatorade he'd brought over.
Did you write?
He asked.
Whenever I picture words, I literally gag.
Beside me, Gus coughed.
That word,
he said.
Sorry. Should we order pizza?
He asked.
Are you kidding? You almost just— January, Gus said. Don't say that word. Just answer the question.
Of course we should. By Monday, we'd mostly recovered. At least enough that we were both working at our own tables during the day. 2,000 words hammered out on my end. Around 1:40, Gus held up the first note of the day. I texted you. I remember, I wrote back, a historic moment in our friendship. No, he said, I texted you a minute ago. I'd left my phone charging by the bed. I held up my pointer finger as I hurried from the room and grabbed my phone. The text just said, "Do you know how to make a margarita?" Gus, I typed back. This is fewer words than the notes you wrote me to tell me about this message. He responded immediately. I wanted to put in a formal request. Writing notes is a very casual form of communication. I don't know how to make a margarita, I told him, but I know someone who does. Jose Cuervo? He asked. I pulled open the blinds and leaned out the window, yelling toward the back of our houses where the kitchen windows were. Google! My phone buzzed with his response. Come over. I tried not to notice what those words did to me, the full body shiver, the heat. I went back for my computer and walked over barefoot. Gus met me on his porch, leaned against the door jamb. Do you ever stand upright? I asked.
Not if it can be helped, he answered, and led me into his kitchen.
I sat on a stool at the island as he pulled out the limes, then went into the front room for his shaker, tequila, and triple sec.
Please don't trouble yourself to help, he teased.
Don't worry, I would never. When he'd finished making our drinks, we went out onto the front porch and worked until the last streaks of sunshine had vanished into that deep Michigan blue, the stars pricking through it like poked holes one at a time. When our stomachs started to gurgle, I went back to my house for the rest of the pizza, and we ate it cold, our legs outstretched, feet resting on the porch railing.
Look,
Gus said, and pointed up at the deep blue sky as two trails of silver light streaked through the stars. His eyes were doing the thing, the Gus thing, at the sight of them, and it made my chest flutter almost painfully. I loved that vulnerable excitement when he first caught sight of something that made him feel, before he could cover it up. He looks at me like that sometimes. I jerked my focus to the falling stars. Relatable, I said flatly. Gus let out a half-formed laugh.
That's basically us, on fire and just straight up dropping out of the sky.
He looked over at me with a dark, fervent gaze that undid the careful composure I'd been rebuilding. My eyes slipped down him, and I scrambled for something to say. "What's the big black blob about?" I tipped my chin toward the updated tattoo on the back of his bicep, where the skin was a bit paler than his usual olive. He looked confused until he followed my gaze.
"Yeah," he said. "It used to be something else."
"A Mobius strip, I know," I said, a bit too quickly. His eyes bored into mine for a few intimidating beats as he decided what to say.
"Naomi and I got them."
Her name hung in the air, the afterimage of a lightning strike. Naomi. The woman Gus Everett had married, I presumed. He didn't seem to notice my shock. Maybe in his mind he said her name often. Maybe having told me she existed felt the same to him as if he'd shown me their photo albums.
"Right after the wedding."
"Ah," I said stupidly. My cheeks went even hotter and started to itch. I had a knack for bringing up things he had no interest in talking about. "Sorry." He shook his head once, and his eyes kept their sharp, fiery focus.
"I told you I wanted you to know me. You can ask me anything you want."
It sounded sort of like, "Get on top of me now." I hoped I looked very pretty for an overripe tomato. Dropping the topic was the smarter idea, but I couldn't help testing him, seeing if I, January Andrews, could really ask the secretive Gus Everett anything at all. I settled on, "What did it mean?"
"As it turned out, very little," he said.
Disappointment wriggled through my stomach at how quickly our open book policy had deteriorated. But then he took a breath and went on.
"If you start at one point on a Mobius strip and you follow it straight around, when you've done the full loop, you don't end up back where you started. You end up right above it, but on the other side of the surface. And if you keep following it around for a second time, you'll finally end up where you started. So it's this path that's actually twice as long as it should be. At the time, I guess we thought it meant that the two of us added up to something bigger than we were on our own."
He shrugged one shoulder, then absently scratched the black blot.
"After she left, it seemed more like a bad joke. Oh, here we are, trapped on opposite sides of this surface, allegedly in the same place, and somehow not at all together, pinned together with these stupid tattoos that are 5,000% more permanent than our marriage."
"Yikes," I said. "Yikes?" I sounded like a gum-popping babysitter trying to relate to her favorite hot divorced dad, which was sort of how I felt. Gus gave me a crooked smile.
"Yikes," he agreed quietly.
We stared at each other for a beat too long.
"What was she like?"
The words had just slipped out, and now a spurt of panic went through me at having asked something I wasn't sure Gus